Welcome to another lesson in 1 Samuel. This is chapter 6. I've entitled it, Who Can Stand Before God? It's taken from the last verse of chapter 6 and seems to be the main theme for this chapter. On the left is a representation of the first meeting between the Ark of the Covenant and the God of the Philistines, Dagon, and his temple. Notice that Dagon is decapitated, his arm severed, and he has fallen before the ark. So who can stand before the Lord? Well, in the first five verses, we find that the Philistines are unable to stand and are looking for ways to return the ark to Israel. In verse 6 through 9, there is a test that is set up to determine if what has happened to the Philistines since the ark was captured and sent to the Philistines, whether it was from God, all the afflictions, or was it coincidence, verse 6 through 9. And testing for God, in 6:10 through 16, a test is set up to determine whether it is God that is behind all that has gone on against the Philistines. And then there's the testimony of the golden mice and the great stone in verse 17 and 18. And in verse 19 through 21, the Israelites, after getting the ark returned to them, are learning how to show respect for God's presence once again. So let's read those first five verses of the text. Chapter 6, verse 1 through 5. The ark of the Lord was in the country of the Philistines 7 months. And the Philistines called for the priests and the diviners and said, What shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us with what we shall send it to its place. They said, If you send away the ark of the God of Israel, do not send it empty, but by all means return him a guilt offering. Then you will be healed, and it will be known to you why this his hand does not turn away from you. And they said, What is the guilt offering that we should return to him? They answered, 5 golden tumors and 5 golden mice, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines, for the same plague was on all of you and on your lords. So you must make images of your tumors and images of your mice that ravage the land and give glory to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will lighten his hand off you and your gods and your land. So let's just kind of review, looking back at chapter 5, why did they want to send the ark back? Well, we know the ark visited 3 towns of Philistia, first Ashdod, then Gath, and then Ekron. In each case, the hand of the Lord was against the people and their God. In Ashdod, it was heavy against people and Dagon, their God. There was terrorizing and tumors. And their question was, what shall we do with the ark? And the leader said, kick it down the road, send it to Gath. Well, Gath, again, the hand of God is against the city. There's very great panic. Tumors, young and old, were affected by these tumors. And the ark was sent on to Ekron. And at Ekron, the hand of God was not just heavy, it was very heavy. And Ekron, when they saw the ark coming, cried out, the ark of God brought to kill our people. For they had heard, evidently, about how the ark had affected the other cities. Well, their decision, or the decision of the elders, was to send away the ark and return to Israel. For where there was a deathly panic, there were deaths, and there's tumors, and those who survived. So in each case, the hand of the Lord becomes increasingly worse from one city to the next. So why 7 months to decide to return the ark? Well, maybe it was pride. Vinoy suggests this, although the ordinary people of Philistia were convinced that the power of the God of Israel was at work in the plagues that accompanied the movement of the ark through Philistine territory, the political leaders, perhaps blinded by considerations of prestige and national pride, took 7 months before accepting the conclusion. Remember, in chapter 5, the ark is set up as a trophy next to Dagon in Dagon's temple. Well, there was bad advice as well. The priests would have had expertise in the treatment of holy objects and issues of purity, where diviners would be skilled in incantations, omens, and magical procedures. So they had lots of people to refer to for spiritual advice, and they waited 7 months to do so. But as we read in 1 Samuel 15:23, rebellion is as the sin of divination. So it was advice that had rejected God and rebelled against God. So it was bad advice, especially for the Israelites. More reasons. Fear. What shall we do with the ark? They cry out in verse 2. Well, sending away an offended and powerful deity was not a task to be undertaken lightly. If done improperly, Yahweh might become even more provoked with dire consequences for all Philistia. The ark proved to be increasingly dangerous as it moved from one city to the next, so they wanted to be very careful to not offend the God whose presence was represented in the ark. As Hebrews 10:31 reminds us, it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. And who best to illustrate that than the Philistines? Well, there's spiritual blindness as well. Now, the writer uses the Philistine dialogue, Bergen says, particularly the statements by Philistia's religious authorities to demonstrate a theological point, the spiritual darkness of Philistia's leaders, the diviners and those who consulted them, was in fact the true source of the present problems. So they went to the source of their problems for advice. Bad idea, blindness. Ignorance might be another reason. They practiced divination and magic that was forbidden to the Israelites in Deuteronomy 18:10-14. And it would have wreaked havoc with one's relationship with God because at their root, they're rival religions, says Omathuna. Guilt might be another reason. Guilt offerings for defilement of holy things was well known in the ancient Near East, so they evidently felt they had defiled the ark. What insight they had came from the schooling they had been receiving. They realized that they had offended a holy God. Yet even with this insight, their desperate attempts to rid themselves of God and his wrath ultimately reveal great ignorance of God and his ways. It's amazing how much they know about God's ways in Israel and Israel's history, and yet they do not take the steps they need to take to completely rid themselves of an offended God. Well, some reasons people send God away today. Well, as the lion and the putty cat represent, that people are often too proud to depend upon God or to submit themselves to God. But James 4:6 reminds us, God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. And with bad spiritual advice, there's better advice found in the scriptures. Jeremiah reminds us, you will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. Jeremiah 29:13. And fear. Well, David prays in Psalm 34, I sought the Lord and he answered me and delivered me from all my fears. They were running away from the one God that could actually deliver them from their fears. Maybe a few more reasons. The spiritual blindness mentioned earlier in 1 Corinthians 2:14, Paul reminds us the natural person does not accept things of the Spirit of God, for they are folly to him, and he is not able to understand them because they are spiritually discerned. And there's ignorance. Romans 1:18-20 reminds us, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. Well, the Philistines had seen enough of the wrath of God in their three towns and the terror and the panic and all that was brought upon them and their refusal to acknowledge that. What a good example of those who are without excuse. How about guilt? Well, the only way to solve guilt is to depend upon the blood of Christ. Hebrews 9:14 says, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God? Well, the Philistines knew enough that they needed a guilt offering. It needed to be a costly gift to make compensation, which is the word for guilt here, for the wrong committed and to ward off further suffering. They wanted to buy off God. And their goal was, if the Lord accepted the Philistines' offering, their people would be healed. Then they would know that his hand had been responsible for their misery. And yet the religious leaders use the term perhaps, which expresses uncertainty about the will of God. So they were hedging their bets about this treatment of God. And the word plague used in this paragraph was used by the Philistines in chapter 4 when the ark first appears in the camp of the Israelites. These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness, 1 Samuel 4:8, and also used in Exodus 9. They knew somehow it was the same God who had plagued Egypt was plaguing them as well. Well, what was the guilt offering specifically? Well, some suggest it was sympathetic magic. That is, an ancient religious protocol prohibited the worshiper from approaching his gods empty-handed. So he had to come up with something. So making symbols of the mice and tumors was an act of sympathetic magic in which the representation of something stands for the reality. Images of mice and other animals believed to have been used in magical rituals have been found in excavations, says Matthews. What is interesting is nobody in the ancient world knew that rats were instrumental in causing plagues, and it looks as if the rats were attacking food stores. That's where the phrase or term ravage might play a part. There were laws against images of animals in Israel's background in Exodus 20, Deuteronomy 5, and Leviticus 26, 1. And mice were considered unclean, so they were making a guilt offering, but it one that wouldn't have really been accepted if the Israelites had done the same. And the religious leaders were told to give glory to God. I like what Baldwin says, by paying tribute to them and so acknowledge his lordship over them. It was God who was victorious in the ark's travel through Philistia. Well, obviously, they needed an acceptable sacrifice, but so do we. Philip says this, they realized that they needed a suitable sacrifice to satisfy God's religious anger towards their sin. Their priest urged this very idea, saying, do not send it empty, but by all means return him as a guilt offering. Then you will be healed, and it will be known to you why his hand does not turn away from you. What the people needed was the right offering to satisfy God's anger so that the plagues would stop. Therefore, they replied, what is the guilt offering that we shall return to him? This is the question with which the entire Bible is concerned. What offering will satisfy God's wrath against sin? Well, here's a suggestion. 1 Peter 1:18 and 19. Knowing that you were ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers, not with perishable things such as silver and gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without blemish or spot. Amen. Well, is it God or coincidence? Verses 6 through 9. Let's read that passage. Why should you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? After he had dealt severely with them, did they not send the people away and they departed? Now then, take and prepare a new cart and two milk cows on which there's never come a yoke, and yoke the cows to the cart, but take their cows home away from them. And take the ark of the Lord and place it on the cart and put it in a box at its side, the figures of gold, which you are returning to him as a guilt offering. Then send it off and let it go its way and watch. If it goes up on the way to its own land, to Beth Shemesh, then it is he who has done us this great harm. But if not, then we shall know that it is not his hand that struck us. It happened to us by coincidence. Well, they needed to prepare their heart for the guilt offering, not just the materials. They learned from the past. The religious authorities, remind them of the history of Israel, of Egypt, and warn them not to harden their hearts. One dictionary puts it this way: it is unresponsive or hard to its proper role of prompting humans to obey God. A heart that is hard does not respond to prompting to obey God. Furthermore, they understand that their choices when confronted with Yahweh's awesome power are either honoring him or hardening their hearts, as Pharaoh did before them. Verses 5 and 6. Learning from the past not only meant avoiding the refusing to obey God, but also that God does deal severely with those who harden their hearts. From Exodus 10:2, it says, "And that you may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson how I have dealt harshly or severely with the Egyptians and what signs I have done among them, that you may know that I am the Lord." Well, the lesson is clear, according to Youngblood. Hardening one's heart, the same Hebrew expression as in Exodus 8 and 9, only brings divine retribution, resulting in the victory of God's people over their enemies, Exodus 12. The Philistines are thus well advised to cut their losses as soon as possible. They had been judged in each of these towns in increasing measures, and it should have brought them to repentance instead of hardening their hearts while preparing the test. There's our cart with the oxen. Well, the word translated cart refers to a wheeled vehicle drawn by some kind of animal. Probably had four wheels rather than two, so thus a representation on the right. And they are yoked, or should be. Probably this requirement reflects the law that requires sacrifices only cows that have never been yoked, Numbers 19:2, Deuteronomy 21:3, and Exodus 20:25. And for similar reasons, perhaps the cart is to be new. What about the cows, the sacrifice itself? Well, the milch cows are cows with young calves that they are nursing. So what was the test? Well, it appears to be in the form of an oracle. In the ancient Near East, when they wanted a natural mechanism for oracles or revelations, they tended to use the liver or kidney of sacrificed animal. Here, the Philistines used a natural mechanism for the oracle. Their yes, no question is whether or not Yahweh, Israel's God, is the one responsible for the plagues. Their oracle mechanism is based on the normal behavior of the cows. Well, what was the normal behavior? The cows that had calves normally would not leave them, let alone pull a cart for the first time and follow a road to unfamiliar territory. And the manner of transport is so designed to assure that the plague is due to IM, not to chance. It was not possible, except for God, for these two cows to avoid their natural behavior and to walk 9 miles carrying an unfamiliar cart, being unfamiliar with a yoke, unless it was of God. And they were allowed to go their way. That means people are not to accompany or direct the cart. Well, the Philistine lords did follow behind the cart at some distance. Well, was it a coincidence? The term could also be translated an accident or refer to something which people cannot foresee, something in the future. Well, maybe a lesson for us is paying more attention to the word. Helm says this: God is not capricious, irrational, or whimsical in any of his actions. But this does not mean that the reason he does things is obvious or is oblivious, excuse me. Nor is God bound to follow some pattern of working which is laid down a priori by his creatures. God is a God of surprises, and takes pleasure in working in unprecedented ways from the vantage points of science and of human religiosity. That is, in ways that are miraculous or unlikely or offensive to human presumptions. Well, 2 Peter 1:19 suggests, and we have the prophetic word more fully confirmed, to which you will do well to pay attention as to a lamp shining in a dark place until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your hearts. We have a better source of advice in the scriptures that are fully confirmed and something we should pay attention to rather than to religious authorities or divination. Well, let's move on. Testing for God, verse 10 through 16 of chapter 6. Let me read. The men did so and took 2 milk cows and yoked them to the cart and shut up their calves at home. And they put the ark of the Lord on the cart and the box with the golden mice and the images of the tumors. And the cows went straight in the direction of Beth Shemesh along one highway, lowing as they went. They turned neither to the right or to the left. And the lords of the Philistines went after them as far as the border of Beth Shemesh. Now the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley. And when they lifted up their eyes and saw the ark, they rejoiced to see it. The cart came into the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh and stopped there. A great stone was there, and they split up the wood of the cart and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. And the Levites took down the ark of the Lord and the box that was beside it, in which were the golden figures, and set them upon the great stone. And the men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and sacrifices on that day to the Lord. And when the 5 lords of the Philistines saw it, they returned that day to Ekron. Well, of course, the answer to the test was, it was his hand that struck the Philistines. Notice the terms, the verbs take, send, return. It's used of Israel. It's used of the Philistines several times, including here in chapter 6, which seems to be a big theme of both chapter 5 and 6. And it was against nature. You have the female cattle whose nursing calves had been taking. They're lowing, they're crying, but they continue on their path straight in the direction of Beth Shemesh. It was the most direct route from the Philistine plain to Israelite territory, to Sumera mentions. It was under divine compulsion, not turning to the left or to the right, that is, staying on the main road, as mentioned in Deuteronomy 2:27, as a phrase of being straight or following the right path. Furthermore, it went to a city that belongs to the priests, according to Joshua 21:16, the ones who were responsible for the Ark of the Covenant. So it was against nature. It went straight and to a city that had priests who were responsible for the Ark. And it was proof or testimony. The Philistine lords watched in verse 9. They followed behind in verse 12, and they saw verse 16, the cows under the care of Levites about 9 months. I think the Philistines had enough proof. Well, let's talk about the people of Beth Shemesh and how they responded. Well, they lifted up their eyes. It suggests an intentional, careful looking. They looked up and fixed their sights on the distance, according to the Net Bible notes. So it was a careful looking towards or gazing upon the ark in the distance. And the response, they rejoiced to see the ark. It denotes being glad or joyful with the whole disposition, as indicated by its association with the heart, the soul, and with the lighting of the eyes. So full-on rejoicing to see the ark returned after 7 months. What is interesting is that the ark stopped. The fact that the animals stopped beside a large rock was understood as meaning that this is where God intended for a sacrifice to be made. So the Levites took down the ark, as the Levites were the only ones permitted to carry the covenant box. According to 1 Chronicles 15, they did their job. Well, what did the Philistines learn? They learned that the awesome, unrivaled authority, Yahweh, in this narrative was something to respect. Furthermore, Yahweh had stooped to show them in terms they could understand that he himself had destroyed their God, their land, and their bodies. Now what will they do with that revelation? Should they not turn and at least begin to serve or fear this obviously real and living God? It is so easy for us sinners, Philistine or otherwise, to respond only to the pain and not to the truth of a situation. Our immediate fears are alleviated, but our heads are no wiser, our hearts no softer. Perhaps the Egyptians have no corner on denseness. So the Philistines began to understand who Yahweh was. They began to understand that what Yahweh's wrath meant, but they stopped short of full repentance. Do we do that today? Well, verse 17, 18, witness of the golden Meissen stone. These are the golden tumors that the Philistines returned as a guilt offering to the Lord. One for Ashdod, one for Gaza, one for Ashkelon, one for Gath, and one for Ekron. And the golden mice, according to the number of all the cities of the Philistines belonging to the five lords, both fortified cities and unwalled villages, the great stone beside which Joshua of Beth, the great stone beside which they set down the ark of the Lord is a witness to this day in the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh. So we have an accounting of the costliness of the guilt offering by the Philistines. Golden figures, golden mice, tumors are mentioned five times in chapter 6, so it seems to be kind of important to our story here, to the writer of this passage. But why five, since only three towns were visited? Well, the phrase here, both fortified cities and unwalled villages, is a merism, referring to both walled cities and unwalled. So it would have referred to the five cities along with the environs around them, the villages, basically for the whole land of the Philistines. So somehow, though the ark only visited three cities and affected those three cities with great afflictions, it affected the surrounding areas as well. How can a stone and golden figures be a witness? Well, if we look through the Old Testament, we find there are quite a number of stones that were witnesses. In fact, in the book of Joshua, there are nine stones set up as memorials. We find more in 1 Samuel, and we find some in 1 and 2 Samuel. It's a memorial to remind future generations of what the Lord did here, the return of the ark. For instance, Joshua 24:17, the stone that Joshua set up as witness against the Israelites so that they would not deny their Lord. Well, perhaps an application will fit this passage. It's good to remember that the Lord did and how we responded, but we must never live in the past. Religious traditions can be helpful or hurtful depending on how we use them, says Wisby. Well, the Philistines remembered enough of Israel's past to respect the presence of a holy God within the ark and what he could do and what he has done with plagues. Let's move on to the last paragraph of this chapter, verse 19 through 21, showing respect for God's presence. Let's read the text. And he struck some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked upon the ark of the Lord. He struck 70 men of them, and the people mourned because the Lord had struck the people with a great blow. Then the men of Beth Shemesh said, who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God? And to whom shall he go up away from us? So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kiriath Jearim, saying, the Philistines have returned the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up to you. So God deals severely or harshly with the men of Beth Shemesh. Why? Well, he struck 70. And that phrase, struck, is very similar to what the Philistines were concerned about. Who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. So it seems that the men of Beth Shemesh are experienced some of the affliction and plagues that the Philistines had experienced. And the reason given is because they looked upon or in the ark. Well, the ark was to be covered with a veil over it when it moved. It was not to be put on display, according to Numbers 4, verse 5 and 6 and 20. And that it was looked upon suggests that it was not covered with a veil as the people looked at the ark. Well, what about the Philistines moving the ark? How come they were not struck? Well, when the Philistines had no access to the special revelation of God, sinned by touching the ark and using a new cart to transport it, God's anger did not burn against them. God is more merciful toward those less knowledgeable of his will than towards those who are more